Okay, let's go ahead and pray and we'll get started. Dear God, we're thankful for who you are, and we're thankful that you are the one who leads us, and that you are the one who even leads us into and through troubles. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the history of your people Israel that we're going to be looking at today. We pray that you would use this in our lives and that you would teach us through this. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so we are continuing in our study of Exodus, and Exodus kind of as a whole can be divided into two parts. We have the part that's dealing with history, and then we have the part that's dealing with worship, which includes the law and the tabernacle and things associated with that. So we've seen at the beginning in the first four chapters dealing with the bondage in Egypt, and then in chapters 5 through 10 we have the plagues and the contest with Pharaoh in that. And then in 11 through 15 is the actual Exodus itself and the people coming out from Egypt. And then the chapters that we're looking at today are part of the section on the early days of travel. And so this will end up that section. So as far as worship, in 19 through 24, we have the institution of the law. And then we have the tabernacle revealed. So that's all that's associated with it. Then we have the incident with the golden calf. And then at the end of the book, the tabernacle is actually constructed. This is just kind of a side note here. But as I was studying, I noticed in these chapters that we have the instances of quarreling and grumbling. And so I was kind of interested in where else that happens. And this isn't exhaustive, but I tried to narrow it down to events where this happens. So there's actually two occurrences of quarreling in Numbers 20, and that is at the waters of Kadesh, and there was no water. And that's actually the other location of a Meribah. So there's actually two places of that. Then as far as grumbling, interestingly, this word is actually only used in Exodus 15 through 17 and Numbers 14 through 17, and then there's one occurrence in Joshua 9. So the first one we had in Exodus is at the waters of Marah. And then in Exodus 16, where the people hungered, they also grumbled there. Here in this chapter, chapter 17, they are thirsty and they grumble. And then the last four are actually in sets of two. And so where one of the instances of grumbling occurs before the event, and then one occurs after God brings judgment after the event itself. So in Numbers 14, that's after the spies' reports, and so they grumble before that, and then they grumble after the unfaithful spies are killed. And then in Numbers 16, that is Korah's rebellion, and so they grumble at the beginning of that, and then after Korah and his followers are destroyed, they decide to grumble after as well. So it'd be kind of interesting to trace that more fully, but this is at least related to those two words. Okay, as far as what we are looking at today, there's basically three main events. So in chapter 17, at the beginning, we have the water from the rock, and so that's the first seven verses. And then at the end of the chapter, there is the fight against Amalek. And then really, chapter 18 is, I'm considering as one unit as far as Jethro's visit, but there's kind of two parts to that. And so the first 12 verses are dealing with him coming and learning about what the Lord has done and him rejoicing in that. And then 13 through 27 is him giving Moses some advice for how to be interacting with the people. Okay, I will go ahead and I'll read these two chapters and then we will take a look at them. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. Then Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah, after he had sent her away, and her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for Moses said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. The other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. He said to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife, with your wife and her two sons with her. Then Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt deceitfully against the people. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. It came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from morning until evening. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning till evening? Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his law. Moses' father-in-law said to him, the things you are doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me, and I will give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. And you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace. So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses chose able men out of all of Israel and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. They judged the people at all times, the difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way into his own land. Okay, so as we start in chapter 17, we need to recognize that these borders are artificial, and so this is connected somewhat with the previous chapter and what happened there. So remember, in chapter 16 is where God first starts to provide manna, and then he also provided meat for the people, and they talked about how the Sabbath was to be observed in relation to the manna. So here we're dealing with the water from the rock, and there's really two parts of this. We have a problem, which is lack of water, and then the solution, which is what God provides for the people. It says here at the beginning that we are still in the wilderness of sin, and this is where they came at the beginning of chapter 16. And in Ezekiel 30, sin is actually associated with Egypt, and so this must have been fairly close to the border of Egypt as it's associated with it there. So it says that the people are journeying in stages, and so that's how they are progressing in their travels. This word journey is kind of interesting. It means to break camp, and so that's what they're doing. They're in tents, and they are breaking camp. But it says that they are journeying according to the command of the Lord, and this is actually more literally the mouth of the Lord. And so the people aren't moving on without the Lord saying so, and so that's even being done here as they're coming to this place where there's no water for them. So here, then towards the end of this verse, it talks about them being they're camping at Rephidim. I thought the word camped was also interesting. It more literally means to draw towards evening, and so if you think about nomadic people, you know, as it draws toward evening, there's something else that's going to be associated with that, which is that you're going to need to camp for the night. They are going to be here at Rephidim until the beginning of chapter 19, when they will leave from there. And Rephidim is also mentioned in Numbers 33. We have kind of more of a pure listing of all the stages in their journey, and so you can see that there as well. So it mentions about this place that there is no water for the people. And so, as I said before, the Lord has led them to this place, and so he will also be the one who needs to provide for them. Notice that verse 2 starts with therefore. So because of this lack of water, we have something that the people are doing. So in the previous chapter, they'd had a problem with lack of food. And so that should have been in their mind, but apparently is not. Mentions then as a result of this situation that the people are quarreling. So this is to dispute. And they're probably doing this in the open, and they're probably saying things. Obviously, we have some of their words recorded here as well. What is interesting is something that Calvin points out in his commentary, which he said, hence too appears their unbelief because they neither expect nor ask anything of God. And so instead of doing that, they are complaining to Moses and not taking their concerns to the right place. Also, notice in this that the Israelites are really expecting the worst of the situation. We know from Romans 8:28 for us that all things are working together for good, and the people should have understood this for themselves, even the Old Testament, because God didn't bring them out of Egypt to kill them in the wilderness. He had a purpose for them, and he was going to successfully bring them into the land. This event is also something that is recorded for a warning in Psalm 95, and this is actually something that's brought up in Hebrews, which quotes from there. So Psalm 95:8 says, "Do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day of Massa in the wilderness." And so this was to be a reminder. The people needed to look back on the sin that they had here and learn from that. The people, in their quarreling with Moses, actually give him a command, and we can see that in the first quote that we have from the people, which is, "Give us water that we may drink." And so really they are asking Moses for something that he cannot really do himself, but that doesn't stop them from doing that. They needed to realize that Moses is the intermediary that they have with God. So in response to this, we have two questions from Moses. Both of them start with why. So he asks them, why do they quarrel? And also, why do they test the Lord? And so notice here that there is a close connection between quarreling with Moses and testing the Lord. And so Moses being God's representative in some sense, anything done against Moses is something that is attributed as to something being done against the Lord as well. So they have kind of this discussion in verse 2, but we can see in verse 3 that like the people are still thirsty, and so that problem still needs to be addressed. In Hebrew, this word thirsted is actually the first word in the verse and also the last, and so that's kind of showing how important that is here. At this point, we have the people grumbling, and so we need to remember that all grumbling is really done against God. Here, more specifically, it says that it's done against Moses, and this is something that's easier to do is to blame things that you can see as opposed to directly blaming God, even though we are implicitly doing that when we happen to grumble or do something similar. So the people ask another question here, which is, why have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? And so the people seem to have forgotten what it was like for them in Egypt. And so instead they are accusing Moses of wanting to kill three groups. So they themselves, their children, and also their livestock. And so this is something I got to realizing, that it's not just that God brought the people out and is providing for them, but the livestock also need to be provided for in all their time in the wilderness. And so we know there were 600,000 men on foot, you know, plus women and children, plus the livestock. And so we don't have any idea on how much livestock that was, but that's another potentially large group that needs to be provided for as well. Okay, so in verse 4, so while the people are complaining because of their situation, what we have here is Moses crying out to God. And so a lot of times this is used of people calling for help, and it's usually in relation to God. And I think this is really the appropriate response and what the people should have been doing as well. When Moses actually says, "What shall I do here?" The word "what" is actually the same word in Hebrew as the people's questions of why. And so there might be kind of a connection between those, where the people are asking the wrong questions. And potentially Moses is not exactly asking the right question here. If he's saying, what am I supposed to do? He really should be saying and asking what God is going to be able to do to provide for the need here. Okay, so as we continue on, we have God responding. So Moses didn't know what to do, so he's seeking the Lord, and the Lord is going to direct him. The Lord gives Moses a few commands here. The first is that he is to pass before the people. And so presumably this is done in the eyes of the people, although I think we'll see from this verse and beyond that I think it's not done in front of the people. I think it's done before the elders. And then he's also told that he needs to take two things with him, which is some of the elders and also the staff that struck the Nile. And so this is potentially done as a reminder of all that God had done for them in Egypt. This is actually the last miraculous action that is done with the staff in Exodus. And so this is kind of, there's kind of been a history with the staff throughout the book so far. So God goes on and says that he is going to be standing in a location. And presumably, I think that this must be some sort of visible representation. So whether this is the cloud or something else, it seems that that is going to be something that can be seen and probably is something that will be an encouragement for Moses and potentially the people as he does this. So it mentions that this is going to be done at the rock at Horeb. And so Horeb was where Moses was back in Exodus 3. And so he's kind of back there, which is part of the promise that God had given to Moses, is that they would come back and worship at this mountain. So what Moses is to do as an action is he is to strike the rock. It's interesting in the situation that Moses is told to strike the rock, and he doesn't, God doesn't strike the people for the rebellion, which would have been appropriate. But the rock is to be struck, and water will come out, so that is the result of that. And there's a purpose in this, which is that the people may drink. So notice in the way that this is worded, I think that this is done just for the elders to see. Notice at the end of verse 6 it says, and Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So it doesn't really say anything directly about the people, but he was told to take the elders with them and do this in front of them. And so perhaps too with the quarreling and grumbling, doing this for the in front of the elders might have been something to help provide the elders with a more clear knowledge of what God is doing so that they could help to be an influence on the people to not do that in the future. And then notice it is kind of pointing out Moses' obedience. He did this as God had told him to. Then in verse 7, we kind of have this being memorialized. So this place is given two names, actually. So Massa, which means trial or temptation, and then Meribah, which means strife. As I mentioned, there's two places named Meribah. There's the one here and then also the one in Numbers 20 as well. Notice that it says that Meribah is named that way. Well, I guess both of these are named this way because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel. So that was mentioned earlier in this chapter. And so these are the two reasons for these names, the quarrel and also that they tested the Lord. And the word Massa is actually derived from that word tested. So in that they are testing the Lord, I think that's relating to them questioning whether or not he was present with them. And so their unbelief led them to think that God wasn't among them in the midst of them there. And so that's why it's related this way. So instead, the people needed to be trusting in the Lord's provision. And so this incident, as well as a number of the other incidents in the Exodus in the 40 years, in 1 Corinthians 10, points back to these and said, these are given to us that we need to take heed, lest we think we aren't going to fall as well. And so these are to be an example to us. Okay, so as we move on, we're moving into the next section, which is the fight against Amalek. And so in verse 8, we are starting with that. And if the people had been wanting a sign that God was among them, then we kind of have one here in the victory that is brought about at this time. So Amalek, if you remember from some of the genealogies in Genesis, was actually a descendant of Esau. And so here in this battle, we sort of have some of that old animosity happening between Jacob and Esau. And this really is the first attempt that we have after Israel comes out of Egypt of something or some group of people trying to stop them from getting into Canaan. We actually have more details recounted about this in Deuteronomy 25. So verses 17 and 18 say, Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you came out of Egypt, how he confronted you on the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary. He did not fear God. And so it seems that as they're going along, they were being attacked when the most vulnerable and the unsuspecting, as opposed to kind of a straight-on attack. So we see then in verse 9 that Moses is calling to Joshua to have him get men together to fight. This is the first time that we have Joshua mentioned by name. And his name means the Lord is salvation, and he's going to help in part of that here. So here, notice that there are things that Joshua needs to do, and also things that Moses is going to do as well. So Joshua is to choose men, he's to go out, and he is to fight, and those are all commands that he is given. It is interesting to think about in this situation that we have here, which is the harder job. To be actually out there fighting, or to be standing and doing as Moses did. So we see in verse 10, we have Joshua's obedience. He did as Moses told him. And we also see that there are some people with Moses as well. So with Moses is Aaron, who we know of, his older brother, and Hur as well. It seems that Hur has some sort of leadership importance. Later on in Exodus in chapter 24, in verse 14, it says, but to the elders he said, wait here for us until we return to you, and behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, have him approach them. It's also possible that Hur might be from Judah's line. I don't know that we can guess on how common a name Hur is, and so it's possible that there's another Hur, but there is definitely one in Judah's line. So then, as we have the battle progressing, there is something that is noticed, and that is there is a correspondence between Moses holding up his hands, at which point Israel prevails, and when he lowers his hands, Amalek prevails. So there is a little bit of a question about what it's meaning by him holding up his hands. I think that is potentially something that is relating to prayer or worship. So in Psalm 28:2, it says, hear the sound of my pleading when I cry to you for help, when I raise my hands toward your holy sanctuary. So that would be an instance of prayer. In Psalm 63:4, it says, I will bless you as long as I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. And so there it's associated with blessing. Also from the New Testament in 1 Timothy 2:8, it says, therefore I want men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without anger and dispute. So anyway, at some point they notice that there's this kind of connection here between the army prevailing and what Moses is doing. And so as we continue, they take four actions to kind of help ensure that they are able to do well in the battle. And so they get a stone, they put it under Moses, they have him sit on it, and then Aaron and Hur are supporting his hands. And so they are grabbing hold of him, they're grasping his arms firmly to help him keep his arms raised. And if you've ever had to be painting above your head or something like that, you realize how quickly your arms get tired. Then we have a result. So notice it says, thus. And we see that they are held steady until sunset. And then kind of to have our summary statement, we see that Joshua is able to overwhelm Amalek. And it was done by the edge of the sword, but also implicitly with God's help, in that God was controlling things and happening to use Moses' raised hands as part of how he was bringing about victory in this situation. The rest of the chapter kind of deals with two ways that this was to be remembered and memorialized. So the first thing is we actually have the first occurrence of right that is mentioned in the Bible. And this is a command that's given to Moses, and he is to write down this as a memorial, and it's to be recited to Joshua. So this memorial, we've had other memorials mentioned previously in Exodus, and chapter 12 is relating to the Passover, and chapter 13, sort of similarly, it was related to unleavened bread serving as a memorial for them as well. So he's to write this, it says, in a book. More literally, that's probably the book, which kind of begs the question, which book? So this apparently is pointing to some book that Moses knew about, that probably Moses was keeping track of events in. And this is done even before the law is given. In Numbers 21, there's an interesting reference. 21 verse 4 talks about the book of the wars of the Lord. So perhaps relating to this and those type of information that's being stored. So Moses was to write this, but then it was written down so that it could be recited to Joshua. Recite here is actually a command, and so this is something that is commanded to be done for Joshua, and because Joshua will become the next leader and what he does and help bring the people into the land. So we're told what is to be written, which is that the memory of Amalek will be utterly blotted out from under heaven. So this word memory is kind of is related to the word memorial, so that's kind of a connection there. And this is talking about the future destruction of Amalek. So I read earlier from part of Deuteronomy 25, the verse after it, which it had provided more details for how this event happened. Verse 19 says, "So it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall wipe out the mention of the name Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget." And so this was recorded multiple places so that they're not going to be forgetting this. And then this is brought to fulfillment as God told Saul to go carry this out in 1 Samuel 15. Additionally, Moses kind of creates a more immediate memorial here for the people, in that he sets up an altar for the Lord here. And this is actually the first mention we have of an altar in Exodus. And in doing this, he also provides kind of a name with it, which is "The Lord is my banner." The word banner does mean banner, but kind of more earlier references to this word are dealing more with a stick with various pieces of fabric tied onto it. And so that could be a reference back to Moses holding up the staff and what was brought about in the victory here. He also says, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." The first instance of Lord here is actually a shortened form of Yahweh. It's just Yah. And another interesting thing relating to Amalek, in Balaam's prophecy in Numbers 24, he actually mentions Amalek. And he mentions Amalek as the first of the nations, but his end will be destruction. And so it's possible, like that's kind of a little bit on the cryptic side, but the first of the nations, potentially the first of the nations that attacked Israel as it came out of Egypt. But also notice that Balaam even there said that Amalek is going to come to destruction. Okay, so as we move into chapter 18, this is Jethro's visit, and the first 12 verses here we'll be looking at his rejoicing in the Lord. So we've had Jethro previously mentioned in Exodus 3 and 4, and there he is also called a priest, and in chapter 2 even, when Moses flees Egypt, he's also referred to as priest of Midian, both in chapter 2, verse 16, and in chapter 3, verse 1. So the question is whether he is a true priest of God or not. I think we have some example that there might be, have been true priests of God outside of the line of Abraham. So we have Melchizedek, who I think was a true priest of God. It says he was priest of God Most High. And also just think about, after the flood, I think we don't have knowledge of God completely dissipating from all the families that were on the earth. And so I think there's probably still potential for there to be other groups of people that had a knowledge of the true God at this time. He is said to be a priest of Midian. So Midian was a son of Abraham through Keturah. And so there's that connection to the Israelites there. And it says that he was able to hear somehow all that had been happening to Israel. And so this news seems to have been able to spread fairly quickly despite the lack of like our more modern communication methods. Kind of similar to this, remember that Rahab and Jericho knew what had been happening as Israel came out of Egypt as well. And one other thing on this, notice that it does say that he heard of all that God had done. And so I think that is meaning that like, there's a fairly substantial detail that is known about all that had happened. So Jethro, it says, took Moses' wife Zipporah. And so he is going to be taking a couple things with him. And this take, we kind of have a little bit of details given in 3 and 4, but the take here really corresponds down into verse 5 where he comes. So he took these things with him and he came to Moses and the people in the wilderness. So we haven't had anything mentioned about Zipporah since chapter 4. And it says here that Moses had sent her away. Some think that this might relate to divorce. I think it doesn't. And I think it's just the word to send back. And so I think that's really more likely what happens here. And you can also skim down and notice that it keeps referring to her as wife. The children are referred to both as her and his children. And so I think all those things point to just a normal separation for a time, potentially because of what Moses was doing in Egypt, although there are some who think that Zipporah and the children went down to Egypt, but maybe were sent back at some time back to Jethro. Okay, so continuing into verse 3, we're still seeing what Jethro took with him, and so we have the son Gershom mentioned. He had been mentioned back in chapter 2, and his name is related to the word sojourner. And each of the sons is really has his name and a reason for why that name was chosen. Thought the definition of sojourner was interesting, especially thinking about like Abraham as a sojourner. But it's a man who either alone or with his family leaves his village and tribe because of war, famine, pestilence, blood guilt, etc., and seeks shelter and sojourn elsewhere, where his right to own land, to marry, to participate in the administration of justice, in the cult, and in war is curtailed. And so he leaves because of some potential benefit, but there are things that he is not able to do because of that as well. Then we have the second son, which is Eliezer, which means God is help. And so that's related to the word later in the verse for help there as well. And both these sons had been born by the time Moses returns to Egypt. And so you can see that in chapter 4. And it mentions here in relation to Eliezer what God had done for Moses, also that God had delivered Moses from the sword of Pharaoh. And to deliver is to snatch away or take away, extricate, rescue. And this word delivered is really a theme throughout this chapter 18 here. So we have it in this verse, but notice also in verse 8, in verse 9, and then twice in verse 10. Mentioned that he is delivered from the sword of Pharaoh. And remember that at the time that Eliezer is born, that Moses is still in Midian. And so which deliverance from Pharaoh was that? Well, it's the deliverance when he fled from Egypt when he was 40 years old, as opposed to what happens later during the Exodus. Okay, so as we continue on, we have notice in verse 5, it mentions the sons and the wife in reverse order. And so we have that chiastic structure. So we have the wife mentioned first, then the sons, and then the sons again, and then the wife, Zipporah. And so we have that structure here. Also, Jethro isn't mentioned again outside or after this chapter. And so this is kind of the last that we will see of him. Says that he is bringing Zipporah and Gershom and Eliezer, and that they are going to Moses in the wilderness. And so we might ask how they were able to find them, but obviously they knew of some of the things that happened in Egypt, and so they might have known the direction that people were going that way. But I think it's also possible after what Moses had happened to him on Mount Sinai that he might have told Jethro about that. And Jethro might have known the promise that God had provided that they would come back to that mountain and worship on it. So he might have known that that would be the place as well. In verse 6, we have Jethro sending a message. And it has mentioned sent. Just the way Hebrew past tense stuff works, this could also be had sent. And this might have been just a politeness to see if it was an okay time for him to come with Moses' family to visit. Then in verse 7, we kind of see what it was like for them to meet. I don't know, presumably this might be kind of a typical meeting and what it would be like to greet people at that time. So we have Moses bowing down, they kissed each other, and they ask about their welfare. And I think from these things that we can see that Moses was glad to see Jethro and his wife and his children. Asking about his welfare, the word welfare is shalom. So this is asking about their well-being and how they are doing. Then we have Moses relating to Jethro various things that had happened. And notice these are recorded under kind of two headings. The first one is all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh in Egypt. And the second is all the hardships on the journey and how the Lord had delivered them. So this is our second mention of the word deliverance. And then notice in these two things that Moses is recounting that the Lord is prominent in both of those. And so both in bringing them out of Egypt and then sustaining them as they continue on this journey. Okay, in verse 9, we see Jethro's response, and I think this is an appropriate response in seeing the work of God. Notice, in addition to the deliverance that God had brought about, he's also pointing out or rejoicing in God's goodness. And so not just the deliverance, but God's continued goodness in addition to the deliverance as well. So verse 10 is really connected to the previous verse as well. And so here we see that blessing is coming out of that rejoicing. Blessed here is actually passive. And so I think that's interesting in that we in and of ourselves aren't fully able to bless God out of ourselves being sinful. And so this is something that God actually needs to be helping us with as well. And we can bless God for who he is and also for what he has done. Notice that God is blessed for two things. Notice the repetition of who. And so he is blessed as the one who has delivered the people from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh. And then the second one who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians as well. Notice that we have hand three times here. And then also notice that we have the Egyptians mentioned first, then Pharaoh kind of in the middle, and then the Egyptians again as well. So there's kind of an emphasis placed on Pharaoh kind of as like the chief example of an Egyptian and what he did to hinder the people. Then we have a continued statement from Jethro that he knows that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Knowledge has been really a big emphasis through Exodus so far, both in the plagues and the other things that God has known, that the Egyptians would know who God is. It mentions also how they dealt proudly against the people. This word proudly is actually one sense of the word is to boil. And so that's kind of, we talk about pride puffing up, but here they're using it in relation to boiling water. And in that they were attempting to be greater than God. So final thing that we have Jethro doing here is that he also brings sacrifices. So he brings two types. So there's burnt offerings, and that's related to something that is burned holy. And so the word burnt offering is actually related to the verb to ascend, to go up, because the smoke of the sacrifice would be going up. And then we have the other word, which is sacrifices here, or a communion sacrifice. which the purpose, it has a purpose of communion between those sacrificing and God. So Jethro's response to hearing what God had done for Israel was praise and sacrifice. So notice we have three things. He rejoiced, he blessed, and he brought sacrifices. And I think that we can see that these are true sacrifices and true worship to God because we have Aaron and the elders joining in this as well. And so I think that is one way we can know that this is true worship. Okay, moving into verse 13, we get to the section dealing with Jethro's advice. You can see another account of this at the beginning of Deuteronomy 1. But here it seems like we have a typical day of what it was like for Moses, and so Jethro is observing that. And so we have Moses going out and he is judging. So this is to decide or settle disputes, make decisions. And he is doing that, and notice kind of in contrast to what Moses is doing, we have the people standing. So presumably Moses is sitting to judge and the people are standing, waiting for judgment. And finally notice that this is like an all-day event from morning to evening. This is what is happening. So in the next verse, we have Jethro kind of observing this, and so he asks a question, and he asks, what is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge? And I think this is his main emphasis, is why are you doing this alone? There is another occurrence of this word in verse 18, and so that's kind of bracketing everything that Jethro is talking about here. So in verse 15, we have Moses giving a reason. Basically, it seems that he didn't see any other way that this could be accomplished for the people. And then potentially in verse 16, this could be a second reason as well that he's providing here as well, that when disputes come up, he has to be the one who helps with that. Also, notice he mentions making known. So again, kind of as an intermediary, he sees that as part of his role, is to make known the statutes and the laws of God. Statutes are things that are prescribed, things that set a limit or an obligation on the people. And then laws are directions and instructions that are provided by God as well. Okay, so then in verse 17, this is where Jethro's counsel starts, really. Notice that he kind of has a similar phrase here, the thing that you were doing is not good. So that's kind of related back to 14 as well. And this is a little bit blunt, perhaps, but notice that he did ask for an explanation first. And so he's not like he was watching first, then he asks, and then he's going to give his thoughts as well. So his objection in verse 18 is that he is going to wear both himself and the people out. This word to wear out is actually used in a metaphorical sense here. More literally, it means to wither or to fall to ruin. And so that's being used about the possible result from this. Then we're also given a reason for this. So notice the word for. The task is too heavy for you, and this is why this would be something that would wear him out. And notice again, we have our word alone here as well. And so we all have, you know, physical constraints at some point, and this is what Jethro is pointing out for Moses. So Jethro doesn't merely object to the current situation, he also suggests a solution, and so that is helpful. Notice in the middle of what he is saying here, we have the phrase, God will be with you. So kind of surrounding this call that Jethro is giving to Moses to listen to his counsel, he kind of interjects that in the middle. So he is saying that Moses needs to be the people's representative, so that's actually a command. And he has to be before God, so that's indicating Moses as being an intermediary between the people. I was reading some of Pastor L.D. Custis's notes on this, and he had an interesting thing, which was, I must come to the place where I believe that it is more important for me to talk to God about my people than it is for me to talk to my people about God. And I think that's not necessarily meaning that you do one to the exclusion of the other, but we need to realize our own inability in who we are to effectively bring about change in other person's life. And so we have to appeal to God to do that, who's the only one who can do that. And not that we don't make any effort on our own part, but we need to realize which is the more important of those. So notice in verse 20, there are two tasks that Jethro proposes that Moses do. And these are to teach and to make known. And each of these has kind of two aspects that go with that. And so in some sense, this could be summarized as doctrine and ethics. Ethics is kind of the practice of putting your doctrine to work. So he is to teach them, so he's to be warning them. Notice that we have statutes and laws, which were mentioned previously, and that's what he's to be teaching them. It's interesting to think what might they have had available at this point before the law is officially given, but I think we can see even through Genesis that they had some knowledge of what was pleasing to God. Also, we can see here the kind of second part of it, which is that he's to make known to them the way in which they're to walk and the work they are to do. The word work is actually related to the word do, so it's like the deeds you are to do. Then in the next verse, there are two more things that Moses is to do. He is to select and to place. And there are four characteristics that are given for these men that are to be put in leadership. They are to be able, fearing God, men of truth, and hating dishonest gain. So they're to have the capacity to be judges in this. They're to be reliable and faithful in doing this, and they're to hate anything that would be leading to dishonest gain. Notice we have four different groups of these mentioned, so with thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. And this is kind of similar to, I was thinking about what we have in the New Testament as far as Acts 6, when the Hellenistic Jews were complaining, that the apostles basically had to do a similar thing. They say there, it is not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables. Instead, brothers and sisters, select from among you seven men of good reputation, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of this task, but we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word. And so really, that's the same thing we have here. Like Moses is going to devote himself to prayer and the ministry of the word and teaching, and the rest of the elders are to handle the needs of the people. Okay, so as we go on here, notice in verse 22, as he's kind of talking about this, that it alternates back and forth between Moses and these new leaders. So notice as you kind of skim through the verse, it starts off talking about them, then it says to you, they, for you, they, with you. And so there's things that both of them need to be doing in this. We have a distinction made here between major disputes and minor disputes, and so that's going to be at which point Moses gets pulled in is with the major disputes. And the goal here is that this would be made easier, and so this is lightning as lightning a yoke when there is a second animal in that harness. And this is presumably because there's more minor disputes than major. Okay, so then we have in 23 kind of a summary here, and that is that there's going to be a blessing for all if this is done. It's interesting that it does say that God so commands you, because we've had God speaking directly to Moses kind of throughout Exodus so far, yet at this point God chooses to speak through Jethro to Moses. So we have two benefits that Jethro mentions here, that Moses would be able to endure, and also that the people would be able to go home in peace quickly. And so both sides would be getting a benefit from this. So what we have is Moses, it says, listen to this, and this isn't just listening to hear words, it's actually listening to put into action. And notice that it mentions all, and so he is doing this completely. It's interesting in thinking about this too that Moses had received lots of revelation from God, and yet here he was humbly and he submitted to this, even though it came through somebody else. Okay, so he goes on and he gets these men selected. Notice that we have Abel is brought up again, and so that was one of the qualifications mentioned earlier. Another interesting thing from L.D. Custis's sermon notes, the tragedy of any generation is immature leaders, and so that's obviously something that was to be avoided here, and it's hopefully something that we can avoid now as well. So notice in these different levels of leaders that are set up that there's actually different, like it's not a constant change between each of these. So there's a different branching factor. And presumably that there are more leaders provided at the lower levels was meant to be a benefit to the people. So there's actually a higher distribution of leaders for smaller groups of people. Then notice in 26 it mentions all times, and so that's kind of going back to what was mentioned before. And here it's mentioning hard versus small as opposed to the major versus minor, but it's really talking about the same thing there. So after this has been done, it says that Moses says goodbye to his father-in-law, and he goes back to his own land while the people of Israel are going to take a little bit a longer time to get to their own land that God has provided for them. So just some things that stood out to me. So the Lord is the one leading the people even when they go through difficulty. And so this is something that seems to really have needed to be drilled into their head as this kind of continues to happen through their 40 years in the wilderness. We need to remember that grumbling is against God and it is really a denial of his involvement in our lives. And so we need to think about that even if we don't see God as actively as we think he might be, because he actually is, even though we don't see it. Notice that the people had kind of quickly forgotten their salvation out of Egypt, and that's kind of something that keeps coming up again and again. And actually, when the Exodus is used as an example elsewhere in the Old Testament, that's kind of brought up, like they came out of Egypt and then they quickly forgot God. From the Amalekite battle, I think we might be able to see that physical battles are sometimes easier than the spiritual side. We need to remember God's deliverance of us, and so Moses did a couple of things to help remember that. And then from the last section here, I think we see that it's detrimental for all when leaders have to lead alone because there's nobody for them to share that burden. Okay, let's go ahead and pray. Dear God, we thank you for who you are. We thank you for what we see of you in this section of Scripture. We thank you for your work among the people, that you even brought them to a place of lack and need so that they could rely on you more, and all the wonderful things that you did for them in the wilderness. Thank you that this is indicators of who you are that isn't confined to time and you're dealing only with the people of Israel. But as it's your character, that means that's how you will be dealing with us as well and providing for our needs as we lean on you. Pray that you'd be helping us and that you'd help us to remember these things even this week, and that we'd be growing in our knowledge and faith of you, and that you would help us to be glorifying you in these things. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.